Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of my introductory talk in our Sangha discussions from our fall 2017 retreat at Wan Dharma Center in Claverack, New York, from October 19th to October 22nd. Our retreats are structured by the Buddha's Dhamma as preserved in the Sutta Pitaka of the Pali Canon. Our retreats are a refuge from the world, but not a retreat from the Dhamma. So we avoid the asceticism of forced silence. Right speech and the entire Eightfold Path provide the framework and guidance to develop the Buddha's Dhamma. This is how the Buddha taught, to develop the framework of the Eightfold Path in order to recognize and abandon ignorance of Four Noble Truths, to empty oneself of ignorance. One of the first rules the Buddha established with the original Sangha is that when gathered as a Sangha, to only discuss his Dhamma and have the Dhamma guide their moment-by-moment lives. In this way, every moment that unfolds is an immediate opportunity to develop and establish the teachings of an awakened human being. Avoiding asceticism of any kind and guided by the Eightfold Path, the mindful interaction of our Sangha during retreat develops the Dhamma as originally intended. As you listen to these seven recordings, notice the lighthearted laughter that is present throughout the talks and discussions and the insight into the three marks of existence that is apparent from the Sangha questions and comments. This lighthearted laughter is an expression of the joy developed from understanding the absurdity of maintaining ignorant views and the realization of the Buddha's simple and direct teachings. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. The Buddha was staying at Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed the monks and nuns. Friends, I will teach you the meaning of an auspicious day. Do not chase after the past or project your thoughts to the future. Not entangled with the world, be mindful only of what is occurring. Free of distraction, well concentrated, develop compassion informed by wisdom. Mindfully engage with what is skillful. The future is uncertain and death occurs equally for all. Those who remain mindfully engaged with life as life occurs throughout the day have had a truly auspicious day. Stop. My new tablet isn't working well. There it goes. Sorry about that. And how does one avoid chasing after the past? One does not get carried away with delight that in the past I had such a form, meaning such a body. In the past I had such a feeling. In the past I had such a perception. In the past I had such a fabrication. In the past I had such a consciousness, such a way of thinking. This is called not chasing after the past. And how does one not project their thoughts onto the future? One does not get carried away with delight that in the future I might have such a form. In the future I may have such a feeling. In the future I might have such a perception. In the future I might have such a fabrication. In the future I might have such a consciousness. This is called not projecting thoughts onto the future. My little commentary in here is notice the eye-making through those self-referential views in those statements. And how does one become entangled with the world? An uninstructed, ordinary person lacking understanding of the Dhamma sees form as the self and the self as that form. Confused, they see feeling as self or self-possessing the feeling. Confused, they see their perceptions as self or the self as possessing perceptions. He's referring to the five clinging aggregates here, isn't he? Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and that ongoing consciousness rooted in thinking born of ignorance.
John, can I say, is that the exact translation, that not belonging to the self? Or whatever?
Yes.
I've never heard it read that.
Confused, they see their perceptions as self or the self as possessing perceptions. Confused, they see their fabrications as self, or their self as their fabrications. And the fabrications, that the second step in dependent origination, from ignorance comes fabrications, mental fabrications. Fabrications are then assumptions about ourself in relation to the world, rooted in ignorance. They're the essence of wrong views, ongoing wrong views. Confused, they see their consciousness as self, or the self as their consciousness. This is what is meant by becoming entangled in the world. Notice how he's relating the five clinging aggregates now clinging to these different aspects, these different qualities of the world. This is how one becomes entangled in the world, by projecting ourselves and clinging ourselves to objects, events, views, and ideas that are completely impersonal. There is no permanent I there, except we continue to do that. It's an auspicious day when we start to recognize that. It's an auspicious day is what's occurring right here, right now. And how is this not, how is one not entangled with the world? A follower of the Dhamma, who is well-versed and well-trained in the Dhamma, does not see form as self or as a self-possessing form. Simple and direct, isn't it? The solution to the problem of wrong views and wrong self-identity is to stop doing it. We don't see ourselves that way anymore. We're going from a wrong view to a right view. We're going from a way of living in the world that is rooted in ignorance to a way of mindfully being a part of the world rooted in wisdom, rooted in true understanding of what's occurring. Mindful of what's occurring. It's an auspicious day, an auspicious moment when we're able to be mindful of what's occurring. Let me read that line again just to lead into the next. And how is one not entangled with the world? A follower of the Dhamma, who is well-versed and well-trained in the Dhamma, does not see form as self or the self-possessing form. With right view established, they do not see feeling as the self or as the self-possessing feelings. With right view established, they do not see perceptions as self or as the self-possessing perceptions. With right view established, they do not see fabrications as self or the self-possessing fabrications. With right view established, they do not see consciousness as the self or the self-possessing consciousness. This is called not being entangled with the world. To develop an auspicious day, remain present with your life as your life occurs. Do not chase the past or project your thoughts to the future. Remain free of entanglements with the world and mindful of what is occurring. Be mindful of impermanence and uncertainty. Those that do so will have an auspicious day. And Siddhartha Gautama concludes this by saying, so says this peaceful sage. Isn't that wonderful? So says that this peaceful sage. Simple and direct instructions on how to have an auspicious day, the most auspicious day we can have. Develop a way of being mindful of your life as your life occurs. And how do we do that? We're going to get to that just now. I thought that'd be a good way to just to start the retreat, though, a good lean-in, just to emphasize just what we're doing here. We're gaining the ability to have one auspicious day after another by being mindfully present with our life as life occurs. The Nagara Sutta, the Buddha describes his awakening. The Nagara Sutta is remarkable in its practical simplicity in describing dependent origination. In this sutta, the Buddha describes his awakening. He shows how ignorance of Four Noble Truths and the Three Marks of Existence originates the process that disappointment, unsatisfactoriness, distraction and suffering, and in a word, dukkha, is dependent on. That's the true meaning of dependent origination. I harp on this all the time because this is the essence of the teachings, and it is this teaching alone that has been misunderstood, misapplied, or completely dismissed that has allowed for all the modern thicket of views that is modern Buddhism. This is what the Buddha awakened to. He awakened to dependent origination. From ignorance to 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. Ignorance points to a quality of mind, doesn't it? And so the solution is to recognize and change that quality of mind from a mind rooted in ignorance to a mind rooted in wisdom. We've created such incredible, intricate, and very powerful strategies to continue to ignore our own ignorance. It's prevalent in modern Buddhism. This weekend is not going to be a diatribe against the horrors of modern Buddhism, but it's important, and I don't look at it that way, but it's important to point that out. The Buddha taught a very simple and very specific and very straightforward Dhamma, framed by the Eightfold Path. Anytime there's an embellishment, an adaptation, an accommodation made to that, those accommodations are done to allow for continued ignorance. We talked about this. So the Buddha often states that the wise know the danger in even the slightest transgression. The most minor deviance from the Eightfold Path. And any time we start adapting or accommodating that to fix a view, to fit a view, we're trying to fit an ignorant view. And that's why it doesn't work. That's why there's such power, but even more importantly, there's such incredible freedom in integrating the Eightfold Path. Why? Because we don't got to think about anything else. We can then be mindful of what's occurring because we've developed the proper framework. We don't even have to consider anymore, is this Dhamma practice? Is this wholesome? Is this skillful? Because we have a reference. Does it fit within this framework? If it does, it is. If it doesn't, it's not. And we can continue to develop awakening in this moment as our life occurs. The three marks of existence are anicca, impermanence, anatta, wrong or deluded views of self, and dukkha, resulting suffering from this initial ignorance. And in the Gara Sutta, the Buddha describes his own personal struggle with ignorance when he was an unawakened bodhisattva. Through understanding the process of suffering arising in ignorance, he directly abandoned the wrong views that would have otherwise continued. I'm having trouble with my new Kindle. The Bodhisattva vow, and again, this is not a diatribe against the Bodhisattva vow, but to point out what has arisen. And it really, the modern application of the Bodhisattva vow could only be possible by ignoring dependent origination, because you'll see how they contradict each other. The Bodhisattva vow, the customary path of awakening in all modern Mahayana schools of Buddhism, is a vow to seek awakening for the sake of all sentient beings. It sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But if you look at that statement closely, that contradicts even dukkha. So the Buddha did not see himself as a savior. He didn't teach a salvific religion. He taught a simple way to recognize and abandon our own ignorance. Often included in the vow is to intentionally delay awakening until all beings are awakened. Even that sounds wonderful, compassionate, doesn't it? I took the vow, and it took me a while, but not all that long, to disavow the vow because I realized the profound implications of what I had just done. It sounds wonderful, but it's lacking wisdom. At first, the Bodhisattva vow path, the Bodhisattva path. Blanket bigger. I can't read it because somehow it shrunk, and I can't get it bigger again. I'll take off my glasses. At first, the Bodhisattva path looks like a selfless, highly compassionate, and reasonable goal. When looked at in the context of dependent origination and the Four Noble Truths, the Bodhisattva vow is seen as taking on the role and self-identity of savior and establishes the Buddhist teachings as a salvific religion. Does everybody see that and understand it? Mm-hmm. So this isn't putting down the notion of a Bodhisattva. The Buddha refers to himself prior to his awakening in those terms repeatedly. When I was an unawakened Bodhisattva, what he's describing himself as is a highly compassionate human being with a highly evolved sense of that compassion, but lacking something key, lacking understanding of Four Noble Truths. And that's why he referred to himself prior to my awakening as an unawakened Bodhisattva. And it's the reason why I'm getting into it. It's not to denigrate the Bodhisattva path, but to point out how that the ideal of the Bodhisattva as the savior of the world is rooted in ignorance and rooted in that beginning process of mental fabrications. So from that ignorance, from that initial ignorance come fabrications. Now comes the fabrication of, I am a Bodhisattva, I can save the world. Or another convenient aspect of that is, I won't awaken just yet, I'll wait for everybody else. It's not possible. Why is it not possible? Because it contradicts the first noble truth. Dukkha occurs. Unawakened people are part of dukkha. It's simply it's a condition of being in the world. And in that sense, we had a really good conversation, Matt and I, about that. And you hear me say this all the time. If we're really concerned about saving the world, we'll take to the Dhamma and awaken. Because that's the only way that we can know that we're not contributing to our own confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering, and the world's confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. And I won't get into that. You know, I want to get to a certain point tonight. I won't get into the notion of how salvation, people have used that ideal to create incredible violence in the world, haven't they? And I'm not now just talking about just Buddhism, but there's a country run by Buddhists who claim to be Buddhists, who claim to be Bodhisattvas, that are committing horrible violence on other people simply because of their religion isn't the same. It's a Bodhisattva vow. Again, I'm not putting down all Bodhisattvas, but that's the result of that type of deluded thinking. It's not possible when you develop the framework of the Eightfold Path. You can't go there. It doesn't happen. The suffering in the world is not due to the lack of a sufficient number of bodhisattvas in the world. It's true, isn't it? The problem isn't that there's not enough bodhisattvas. The problem is that we don't understand what's occurring. We're lacking wisdom. We're stuck in ignorance. Dependent origination shows that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths. This thing is messing up. The suffering in the world is not due to the lack of a sufficient number of bodhisattvas in the world. Dependent origination shows that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. In a somewhat subtle way, taking the altruistic vow to save all sentient beings creates another self-referential identity as the Savior. The Buddha never presented himself as a Savior or his Dhamma as a salvific religion. The Bodhisattva role is a highly compassionate state, but a preliminary state to awakening. If saving all sentient beings was a reasonable and complete path to awakening, there would be no need for an Eightfold Path. Individual development of understanding, as described in the Nagara Sutta, would be unnecessary. Again, the Buddha didn't awaken and teach people to be, or even to take, a Bodhisattva vow. He taught an Eightfold Path. And when we get to, I think it's Saturday night, or Friday night, when I teach the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, you'll see how that, his very first teaching, relates not to saving the world, but to changing the way you think. And this is the teaching of an awakened human being. He didn't teach salvation. He didn't teach it as a path. He taught that the path to awakening, to gaining full human maturity, was to recognize and abandon ignorance. And along the way, we develop an understanding of the incredible strategies we've all created to continue to ignore our own ignorance. That's why the Eightfold Path is there. How does a deluded person know that they're deluded? How could you? Unless you had a framework for recognizing that delusion, that ignorance. The Buddha taught for 45 years, presenting many thousands of suttas. There is no mention of substituting a Bodhisattva path for the Eightfold Path for the reason I just gave. If the Bodhisattva path developed awakening, the Buddha would have simply taught to develop great compassion. In fact, he really taught just the opposite. We should not be practicing compassion until we've developed wisdom. Because great harm can come. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't be loving and compassionate people and be hypervigilant. I'm not awake and I can't be nice to anybody. It does mean that we should recognize that if we're starting to take on causes, that we might have a way to go for ourselves first. You know, the Buddha didn't do anything for anybody. And he was in a... Remember, the Buddha was born a prince in his father's kingdom. And he had great compassion at that time. He was a bodhisattva. But he didn't do anything, did he? He first sought awakening. before he started contributing to the world. And that doesn't mean for the 6 years that he was wandering around that he wasn't being helpful to people. That's not what I'm saying. But he didn't start teaching a Dhamma until he knew what he was teaching. And then he became a truly compassionate human being married with true wisdom. And that's why I say repeatedly, over and over again, the most loving thing we can do for ourselves and for all sentient beings is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. Because then our natural compassion will be married with wisdom. And we can truly do some good in the world. And boy, the world needs it now more than ever, doesn't it?
John, there's a big difference between being a nice person and being compassionate from a Buddhist perspective.
Yes, there certainly is. There's a little bit more, and I want to just get to the Nagara Sutta. And just lead into it with this. If the Buddha decided to delay his awakening until all others somehow became awakened, he would have spent eternity in this unsuccessful search, wouldn't he? Because he'd still be waiting. And we'd still be waiting for his teaching. If the Buddha intended to be savior of all sentient beings, he would have embraced the salvific dharma of Alarakalama or Dekaramaputta, which is the two famous spiritual teachers that the Buddha studied with and discarded their teachings, is not leading to his goal. Some of the teachings are that as soon as the Buddha became awakened, and this is particularly true in some Mahayana schools, and again, not putting it down, just pointing out the difference and the difficulty there. When the Buddha became awakened, all beings became awakened. It's not what the Buddha taught. Why would the Buddha have taught a very specific Dhamma for 45 years if upon his awakening it would have been just a foolish waste of time, wouldn't it? And we wouldn't be here tonight. So again, it's not something... The reason why I'm making that point is there is something we have to do if we wish to awaken. We can't just hope for it. We can't just act in a certain way. We have to develop an Eightfold Path. Now we're going to get to why. The whole point of all that introduction. The Nagara Sutta. The Buddha, again, was at Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed those gathered. Friends, before my awakening, when I was only an unawakened bodhisattva, I came to the realization of the difficulties of the world. Now, just remember the whole background to this. When I was just an unawakened bodhisattva, I then came to the realization of the difficulties in the world. The world is born, it ages, it dies, it falls away, and then it returns. But there is no understanding of ending the stress and suffering of aging and death. So we're caught in this endless cycle, but there's no understanding. Now, the Buddha is talking about human beings rooted in ignorance of the way things really are. There's no understanding of being caught in the process. We're just in the process. And worlds are being born and falling away and being born and fall away. We're talking about eons and eons being stuck in the word that's often used, being stuck in samsara. And we don't even realize what's going on. Why? Because we're ignorant. It's the essence of a deluded mind. We're just going through the motions of suffering and continually suffering because of it. And we're bodhisattvas at the same time. Some of us may be. When will the world understand the cessation of the stress and suffering from aging and death? And he's not talking about the common problem of being 62 and starting to feel it. The cycle of aging and death and being stuck in that samsara. When will the world understand the cessation of the stress and suffering from aging and death? I know I read that twice. That's the point. How do we bring this to cessation? Now the Buddha is describing how he came to this understanding. Then I had the thought, what initiates aging and death? What is the requisite condition that aging and death are dependent on for arising? How does all that wandering and samsara arise? What causes it? The Buddha continues, from my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. Holding in mind the right view, from my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough in understanding. The Buddha's is talking to a group of people and describing his own awakening process. This is one of the most remarkable things I've ever read. I didn't read this. This is not the first thing I ever read. In fact, it came many years before I discovered this. I think this is the first thing that anybody who's interested in Buddhism should read, and that's why I'm starting off the retreat with it. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From birth, as a requisite condition, comes aging and death. It makes perfect sense, doesn't it? If I'm not born, there's no aging and death. So then the problem is, how do I figure that out and not get born? How do we not get born?
Great, so, links of dependent origination.
Notice how dependent origination. We're gonna go through that. Now, I need to point out at this point, we're not talking about only physical death and rebirth, although that's a component of it. It's actually a minor component of the notion of birth. And we're going to get a little bit more into that tomorrow morning when I get into the meanings of becoming and the three suttas, Aloka Bhava and Mula Sutta. The idea of becoming, and I think it's the seventh link, the Buddha says from clinging and maintaining comes becoming. All of dependent origination is rooted in that initial ignorance. So if we're continuing in that process of rooted in ignorance, the only thing we can become is more ignorant. But if we find something that we can use to interrupt that ongoing process, to interrupt ignorance, then we can become awakened. And that's the potential that each moment has. That's the potential that we are experiencing right now. What am I going to become? So let me get back to this. I have to keep going back just to keep it in context. Then I had the thought, what initiates birth? What is the requisite condition that birth is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From becoming, as a requisite condition, comes birth. That's the translation. It's the same translations that's used in even the accurate translations of dependent origination. There's no qualifier or a modifier to becoming. It's always presented that way. Comes becoming. Even in this translation. From becoming, as a requisite condition, comes birth. But you have to remember the context that the Buddha is teaching this. So the modifier, the correct modifier or qualifier for becoming is from becoming ignorant, as a requisite condition, comes birth. You have to keep it in the context to make sense out of the Buddha's teachings. And that's the context he's teaching. From becoming ignorant. And so now the Buddha is not talking about it's because I'm ignorant that I was born. It's because I'm ignorant, now I'm giving birth to moments rooted in ignorance. That's the important teaching on what we give birth to. And we will touch on the notion of karma and rebirth as it relates to future births and the meaning of that, but that is almost meaningless. What's important is what are we becoming right now, and that's what the Buddha is describing in his awakening. The Buddha continues, then I had the thought, what initiates name and form? Name and form is part of the dependent origination. Name and form, the Pali word is namarupa. It's simply identifying or putting a name to the form. This is John. The process of self-identification and self-referential views. Remember, self-referential views rooted in ignorance. Name and form. Then I had the thought, what initiates name and form? What is the requisite condition that name and form is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From consciousness, as a requisite condition, comes name and form. So again, remember, this isn't consciousness with a big C, grand consciousness, where we're all of one mind. It has nothing to do with that. It's consciousness. Consciousness in this context is ongoing thinking rooted in what? Rooted in ignorance. This is what the Buddha is referring to. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form, comes this self-identification. Now this is important because now the Buddha is going to start describing the feedback loop that we all get caught up in from self-identification. Then I had the thought, what initiates consciousness? What is a requisite condition that consciousness is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From name and form, as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Do you see the feedback loop in there? From self-identification comes ongoing consciousness, from that consciousness rooted in ignorance. From that ongoing consciousness rooted in ignorance comes the feedback loop of here I am again. Stuck in the... Does everybody see that? Because it's somewhat subtle, but it is the problem. That is the essence of ignorance, being stuck in the feedback loop of self-identification being reinforced by consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance, rooted in wrong views. That's also, and we may have time to get to this, I'm not sure, that is also karma, and I only bring that out to point out that the word karma means action. It is that ongoing action of maintaining that feedback loop of self-referential views rooted in ignorance, feeding back on its own ignorance, that maintains the experience of karma. It's that specific action. When I talk about the intricate and powerful strategies that we all create to continue to ignore ignorance, that's what I'm referring to, that feedback loop. Is everybody at least relatively clear on that? It'll become more clear as we go along. That's really kind of what we're talking about.
So that's eye-making.
That's the essence of eye-making.
That is eye-making.
Yep, and you think about, you're looking at a wrong view, an ignorant view of yourself, and you're saying, that's me.
Exactly.
Stress arises, doesn't it? It's me, it's got to be me. There's nothing else if it's not me. And what about when you hate that? We talked about that. There's a lot of self-loathing that goes into creating these strategies. It's not saying that we're all stuck in self-loathing, but there's an aspect of that. And we create incredible strategies to keep this going. Now listen to how the Buddha is recognizing this. He's describing how he came to grips with this within himself. Let me read my commentary. What the Buddha is beginning to describe here is the feedback loop caused by self-referential views, then relying on those views rooted in ignorance to describe self-referential reality. Mm-hmm. And you all see that, don't you? It's remarkable that you see it.
Yeah.
This is much like that saying, I think, therefore I am. The famous quote from, I don't want to say his name right, but from René Descartes. Who hoped, his reason for doing that, he was trying to find let me read it. He hoped to find an irrefutable statement. He wanted to, his whole purpose of, and the underlying motivation behind his search, his philosophical search, was to find a statement that could not be refuted. And he concluded that the statement would be, I think, therefore I am. That's what the Buddha is describing as the feedback loop, the self-referential feedback loop. Just because I see myself, that must be me. No matter how confused and deluded, no matter how unsatisfactory that face in the mirror is, that's me. And I'm going to do everything I can to maintain that and defend it. Rooted in wrong views, rooted in ignorance. His reasoning was that he could not refute his own existence, so the statement must be true. It's certainly just a self-referential statement. Lacking understanding, the resulting reality described ignores or continues ignorance, and any thought, word, or idea that would arise that would challenge that ignorance, that challenge that view, is now conditioned by that ongoing ignorance. That's even a hard thing to kind of get your head around, isn't it? But because it's that feedback loop. So the only reasonable strategy, the only way that I will now engage in the world is if what I'm clinging myself to reinforces my view. Because everything else is a threat to who I think I am. And we'll go to great length, either within modern Buddhism, or put that aside and create these incredible spiritual understandings that only continue to that self-referential views. And they all sound reasonable. And most of them are very agreeable because of what they provide. They provide a great vehicle for distraction, a great vehicle to not recognize the personal experience of suffering through the five clinging aggregates. Larry.
So you described that the problem is in the mirror, and then I've heard it said that the solution is there as well. So is that, and would that be proper in this context?
In recognizing that,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
In recognizing that, because then you realize that the mirror is the self-referential view, the feedback loop. But it takes a framework to actually see that. And the Buddha will describe, I'll describe it in just a moment. Once established, the framework for recognizing this feedback loop is now necessary in order to recognize and abandon these wrong views. We have to understand that I'm just stuck in that feedback loop. I'm looking in the mirror. When the Dhamma is developed, it is clearly understood that what constitutes a self is always in a constant state of becoming, rather than the notion of a fixed permanent self that arises from wrong views, that I can establish myself as this at any point, meaning a fixed permanent self. That's the notion that would say that this soul migrates or transmigrates from one life to the next life as me, as this one individual soul. That's one of the great breakthroughs that the Buddha is describing here. There's no such thing as a soul. There's nothing permanent. The self, what we see as a self, is impermanent. The three marks of existence, impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and the resulting dukkha, it's because of a misunderstanding of the self in relation to impermanence, meaning not recognizing it, that dukkha occurs, that all manner of suffering arises. When we recognize, when we truly penetrate the Dhamma, we realize that what we consider a self is simply a reference point to what's occurring right now. And that reference point is always in a constant state of what? Becoming. And so the question is, what am I going to become? If what I'm holding in mind now are principles rooted in ignorance, I can only become more ignorant. And I'm only prone to more confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing unsatisfactory experiences. If I can find a way to interrupt that process of becoming more ignorant, recognize my own ignorance, recognize the strategies that I've developed to continue to ignore my own ignorance, then I can interrupt that process and I can become awakened. And that's a personal and individual choice, isn't it? Most of us don't have it if we're rooted in ignorance. So then we have to make a choice somewhere along the line to recognize that the way I'm looking at the world right now isn't working. What can I do to interrupt it? Those of us that are here have chosen to use the Four Noble Truths to interrupt that in the Eightfold Path. We've chosen a path that an awakened human being realized and taught 2,600 years ago that's still available right here, right now. So let me continue. So, the difficulty, these are still my words, the difficulty that many have with seeing this clearly is that a mind rooted in ignorance insists on ignoring anything that challenges ignorance. I know I've said that probably six times already, but that's really the key point. Understanding this one point is the essence of the Buddha's Dhamma. The Buddha continues, "Then I had the thought, this consciousness turns back at name and form and goes no further." It gets stuck there. How do you get out of it? And we all know, we've all been, we can experience that right now, can't we? We know what it feels like to be stuck in that feedback loop and not even understand, how did I get here and how do I get out of it? The Buddha just realized he got stuck there. "Then I had the thought, this consciousness turns back at name and form and goes no further." It's a dead end. "It is to this extent that there is birth, aging, death, falling away, and returning. From being stuck in that point, all manner of suffering arises. It is to this extent." This is where ignorance is established, in that feedback loop. And we can't go any further. Once we're in that loop, the only thing that we can experience is described in the First Noble Truth. Dukkha will occur. The Second Noble Truth says that craving originates and clinging perpetuates. Dukkha. It's craving for that initial self-establishment that gets us stuck in that feedback loop. The most important thing that the Buddha ever said, even though every word he ever said was somewhat equally important, was that cessation of this process is possible. And that's only allowable because of impermanence. If there wasn't such a thing as impermanence. So impermanence is both the problem and it's the solution. because impermanence allows for change. It allows us to go from a mind rooted rigidly in ignorance to a mind that is supple and rooted in wisdom. The fourth noble truth is the truth of the path leading to the cessation of that, the only path the Buddha ever taught, an eightfold path. This is where ignorance is established. Name and form, or self-referential views, my words, that's not part of the sutta. Name and form is the requisite condition that brings consciousness, and consciousness is the requisite condition that brings name and form. Self-identity rooted in wrong thinking, ignorant thinking, ongoing conditioned thinking rooted in ignorance, used to promote self-identity, this is me, is the problem. It's the ongoing feedback loop. Let me read it again. This is where ignorance is established. Name and form is a requisite condition that brings consciousness, and consciousness is a requisite condition that brings name and form. I would bet some of you are a little bit uneasy, and you might not even be that aware of it, of the idea of consciousness being the problem. No. Because it is with our thinking that we become enamored. It's with our thinking that we establish ourselves. And so the initial recognition can be pretty unsettling at first. Wait a minute. He's not saying that it's my thinking that's the problem, because it's my thinking that's me, isn't it? Remember that it's thinking rooted in ignorance. And any thinking that's rooted in ignorance is like foam on the ocean. There's literally nothing there of substance, except it feels like everything, doesn't it? And when we start going through the process of recognition and abandoning, meaning recognizing wrong views and abandoning those wrong views, it often feels like annihilation. It feels real. It feels solid. It feels like we're dying. And there's nothing there. It's just holding on to wrong views. It's just part of that clinging and maintaining. The Buddha here is clearly stating that it is self-referential views that establish and continue eye-making. Continued eye-making continues dukkha. This directly relates to his use of the word anatta to mean not-self, meaning self-referential views rooted in ignorance are not a self. The modern interpretation, and even during the Buddha's time, the word anatta was meant to say that, well, there's no such thing as a self. And Matt and I had this kind of, there's a quite a strong element in self-loathing and attaching yourself to that doctrine, because it allows for the complete annihilation. There's no, really nothing here, and since I don't really like myself, that's a pretty good doctrine. There's no me. Everything is nothingness, everything is empty. Again, these are things that Buddha never taught. Recognizing that we are the cause of our own suffering is also a recognition of the cause of self-loathing arising, isn't it? I did it to myself. And when we can start taking responsibility, and that doesn't mean that every one of us is full of self-loathing. It's a common byproduct of ignorant thinking that there's a subtle form of self-loathing in a lot of this continued eye-making. When we recognize it, we're able to start taking control of our own thinking. That the sutta from Tuesday night, the Vitakkasanthana Sutta, we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. We gain the ability to ultimately have only skillful thoughts. So the Buddha used the term anatta to not say there's no such thing as a self, simply to point out that the views that you're holding of a self aren't a self. They're anatta. They're not a self. They're wrong views. Let go of the views. And he taught a way to recognize and abandon those wrong views rooted in ignorance. The Buddha continues, then I had the thought, The sixth sense base, our five physical senses and our ongoing consciousness, the sixth sense base is dependent on the condition of name and form, dependent on self-referential views. This is the origination of the entire mass of suffering. I think I need to read that again, don't I? Yes. Then I had the thought, the sixth sense base, then I had the thought, my senses and my thinking rooted in those senses or driven by those senses. Then I had the thought, the sixth sense base is dependent on the condition of name and form and dependent on self-referential views. Now our senses are being used to continue that feedback loop. Now, remember, there's the Buddha's teaching a progression rooted in ignorance. From that ignorance came self-referential views, name and form. This is me. And because my thinking is rooted in ignorance, I've now become stuck in this feedback loop. And now, because I've identified myself as a form, and that form has physical senses, everything that comes in contact with that form now is only reinforcing that feedback loop. It's only that's the only possibility. It can only reinforce ignorance.
We're only letting that in.
Because the view has become so narrowed that this is me, that the only thing that we can see is a personal experience of what's occurring. We've lost the ability to see things from right view, which is a completely impersonal way. So to simplify this a little bit, dukkha rooted in wrong views, dukkha rooted in ignorance, is taken personally. We experience life personally. This is happening to me. Awakened view, something that has recognized and abandoned ignorance, doesn't take anything personal. Notice a description of an awakened human being. An awakened human being is a fully mature human being. A fully mature human being doesn't take anything personal, do they? Just like a little child takes everything personal. And sometimes even adults take everything personal when they don't get that second piece of chocolate cake. When I'm awakened and I only get one piece of chocolate cake, that's fine. Again, those that don't know me know I use that silly metaphor at times, but it does make the point, doesn't it? The point of to awaken is to gain full human maturity, to not take anything personal. Another way of saying that is to not engage in eye-making with anything. The Buddha gave a clue. Give me 1 second. The Buddha gave a clue as to how to handle this in situations when we're becoming agitated or finding ourselves. And agitation could be not just being annoyed. It could be excitation. It could be something we're feeling really good about. But it's an agitated mind. And he said, what to do? Recognize that this is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. That's the essence of mindfulness that he taught the Bahia in that great sutta. Recognize, this is not me. Whatever arises, whatever one cognizes, is simply cognized. Whatever you hear is simply what you hear. Whatever you taste, whatever you see, it's simply what is occurring. Going back to the beginning of the Bhadakarata Sutta, then auspicious day is when we can engage in that ongoing process of simply being present with life as life occurs. It's the entire teaching of the Dhamma. Wait, Maury, you had a question or a comment?
You kind of just said it, because that not taking anything personal is not just in reaction to that which we view ignorantly as negative, but it's I want this, I want more of that, more of this is going to help me with that. You know, that's I think the personalization of that which is just occurring in space and time.
Yeah, all part of thank you. When the Buddha described dukkha in very simple terms, birth is dukkha, birth is suffering. Sickness, aging, and death are dukkha. Not get what Morris is referring to, the Buddha's words, not getting what you want, what is wanted, is dukkha. And it is. And it seems so simple. Why did it take an awakened human being to point that out? Because we don't want to face the fact that in some ways we're babies, we're immature. I didn't get what I want. I'm not happy. My life isn't good. There's something wrong with me.
But not even like I wasn't even saying in the negative. And just thinking that I need that water. There's thirst and the body needs something to function. But even if you do get what you want, the idea that I need that. And I'm going to put that in, and that is, just like what I, for some reason I don't probably, it's not that I didn't hear it, that piece of also the phraseology of, in the beginning of that sutta, of this vehicle, thinking that it owns that feeling. that perception, that thought. So we always talk about in the class, right, establishing oneself, clinging to the thought, to the perception, to the feeling. But that's another layer, an important phrase of,
yep.
I feel like I hadn't heard before, read before. No, it's this ignorant identification with a solid entity that when I say I'm sad, it's I'm owning that feeling ignorantly.
Yes, when it's rooted in that wrong view.
Rather than just recognizing a sensation is occurring and passing by without making more of it, identifying with it, and
analyzing it, embracing it.
Yeah, forget about analyzing it. But even just like, and then wanting, of course, the ignorant piece is either wanting it to go away or wanting it to continue.
Yeah, and wanting more of
it. Therein becomes the agitated mind state that is maybe not angry, but is in craving and clinging.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes, you know, often you hear people say, oh, dukkha, so everything is like the negative piece that I'm always bringing up. You know, it's nobody wants to own that it's the in common terms, the positive piece, too.
Yeah. All of that is.
We don't
want
to look at that.
So,
I'm happy. Don't make me see that.
One of the reasons that some people, when they start coming to that initial understanding, say, I don't want any of this because you're saying that everything sucks. It's simply recognizing that even those things that give us pleasure, and that's fine that they do, mm-hmm. but when we start creating a scenario that we must have them and identify with those things, that's where the problem arises. Mm-hmm. That's where the true understanding. So it doesn't mean that we shouldn't enjoy our life. In fact, when we're fully mature, we're able to appreciate and find meaning in everything. And those things that are pleasurable are even more so, but we're not attached to it. We don't need more of anything. And conversely, those things in life that are naturally going to occur, because they're part of living in the world, suffering that we have no control over, is simply that. We understand it as that too. And it doesn't have to be any different. So let me...
It seems like the mindfulness of Bahia is really rolling back the sixth sense base.
Mm. Yep. And using it in its appropriate way.
Right.
The way that you and Lorna had that discussion why don't you describe that? So I can stop talking for like 1 minute anyway. Can he really stop talking? I don't know.
Lorna and I were talking in Qigong class one time about... Lorna asked the question, so when we're... cultivating chi or sinking the chi or something like that, is it my chi, is it something that is personalized, is there ownership of it, and I said no there it, that's a good question, but it's not that, it's that led to, there are all these processes in the body that are happening without me being there or doing, breathing, circulation, the heart beating, kidney filtering things, the lymph system, all of those things don't require me there. Yeah. So the body will organize itself and do what it needs to do on its own without a overseer in that way. So that was that what we were talking about?
Yeah.
So in this example of you know, thinking of Bahia, the mindfulness of Bahia, and that presentation that the Buddha gave him before he got ran over by a cow was rolling back this sixth sense, this personalization of the sixth sense base, of the phenomena that comes through the sense gates, that instantly, because we're looking in front of the mirror, you know, and what we were saying was, when we're sitting here in meditation class and our eyes are closed and we open up our eyes, what's there when we open up our eyes? Our lives, my vision, my sight, my all these things that instantly are named and related to me, right?
Yeah.
A self-referential experience.
They've been there all along.
Right, and it, actually, it's the phenomenon of sight or vision also doesn't have anything to do with me.
Yeah.
You know,
and what is seen there is only the seen.
Right.
There's no you in it.
So there's that in that way of Bahia. Really, that's a really cool sutta in that way, is that it's rolling back that sixth sense basis, saying, no, Bahia, that's not, you're not there. You're not in that.
It's the same thing as saying, being with what occurs is simply what occurs.
Mm-hmm.
You've taken out the self-referential part of the sixth sense base. Do you see what we're... So then, what is occurring... What is the self is simply a reference point to what's occurring. And for some people, it's hard to even imagine living life that way. That there's, but it the best description of that is the most successful and important life ever lived. That's how the Buddha lived the last 45 years of his life. He was able to interact with the world in an incredibly... There is often stories about the Buddha must have had certain clairvoyant and psychic powers. The Buddha never claimed that for himself. But because he was able to be so mindfully present, he could see someone for just a moment and understand them completely. It seemed like a magic trick almost. But we can do that, and I'm not saying we're trying to develop magic in our lives. It's just the opposite. We're gaining the ability to be present with what's occurring, with our own life as our life unfolds, without any me needing it to be any different, without my own ignorant views clouding the perception of what's occurring and insisting things be different than they are. I use a silly example of a piece of chocolate cake, but we do that with everything. A self-referential ego self, anatta, must establish itself in every single event, word, idea, notion that occurs. Everything must be self-reflective, or that anatta, that ego self, becomes very threatened and agitated. And that's the beginning of psychoses. And I'm not trying to give my own solution to anxiety and that type of thing. That's not what I'm talking about. But that's the underlying focus of it. Liz, you had a...
This came up in class one day where, I forget who was asking the question, but they said, so how do I describe the me, the I? If there is not a self, how do I describe that? And then you had said that it's just a reference of this form in time and space. You know, it's not necessarily the idea that referring to yourself as me or I makes that condition self-referential in a negative way. But you're describing yourself as an object or a point in space in the phenomenal world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And what's underlying that, what underlies eye-making, is your intention. If your intention is for eye-making, then it is. An awakened human being still describes himself as I. The Buddha was an awakened human being, and he said, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva. We have to be able to communicate. The framework of the Eightfold Path shows us if we're eye-making in that communication. So the Buddha wasn't bragging or even establishing himself in any self-referential way. He was simply stating the truth, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva. And even when he awakened, he referred to himself, he never called himself the Buddha. He called himself the Tathagata, which simply means, basically means the guy that figured it out, the guy that did it first. Larry.
So I think if I understand what Liz is saying, it's the use in this context is a one of convenience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And communication, like if I was to say, I'll see you at 9:00.
Yep.
We made that up.
Yeah, and it's...
The time, right? It's just a convenience factor.
Yes.
Yeah. And how else would we live in the world?
Right.
So the fact that I'm making is a problem doesn't mean referring yourself to yourself as I is a problem. What's underlying it? You know,
and I'm trying to figure out how to take it out of my vocabulary completely, but now I'm comforted by the fact that I can still use it to communicate.
Yeah, in fact, you have to. It's an extreme view. It's something that when people first start coming to the Dhamma, your mind naturally goes there. Well, okay, what do you mean? I can't even refer. That's an extreme view. You know, again, the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. He always described it as a middle way between those extreme views, meaning that it allows us to live human life as awakened human beings and to have that life. But we're now simply a reference point. You know, there's no more me. I'm no longer trying to establish myself. Maury, how did...
Maury was first. I was just going to say, because at that time, too, it depends... It's a wisdom perspective. I'm sorry, I started saying when you're there. I don't think that this is me. So that's a wisdom perspective. It's seeing that freeing, you know. But of course, I'm going to refer to for convenience. But I don't identify with that. Sometimes I do, of course. But often, you know, I'm not. I'm not confused all the time. sometimes I am, and the one thing that I would just say about
there was such an opportunity there, but I let it go by.
the wisdom of Bahia, and the Qigong episode, and all that. And, I find the skillful means of that is when the mind is settled. Through Qigong practice or something, it becomes very apparent that I am not controlling the movement of Qi, and I am not controlling heartbeat and all that. So it's a skillful means in terms of loosening the identification that there is some controller here. Mm-hmm. So the resultant factor is another chisel away at the ignorant self that is gaining momentum and snowballing down the road.
And you could that view on feelings as well. Feelings are
correct.
Completely automatic.
Yep.
That's not you, that's feeling. It's the body.
Yeah,
and from a wrong view, that feeling is only going to reinforce
right.
it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
When you're settled in right view, you don't stop feeling.
No.
It simply doesn't condition your mind anymore.
Okay.
This is getting into an area that is rather common, but it's driven by wrong views. Because the self-referential ego self wants to say, well, I can't let go of what happens to me. I can't even say the word. The Buddha in his whole sutta, I mean, he refers to himself throughout his teaching career, but in this particular sutta, he's saying, I had this thought. And again, take it in context. Well, here's an awakened human being. He's okay with referring to himself in that way. Why? Because he knows it's not self-referential. He's not reinforcing that, his own wrong views. And that's where the framework of the Eightfold... So how do we know when we're doing it and when we're not doing it? That's why the Eightfold Path is there. How does a deluded mind know it's deluded? How does an ignorant mind know that it's ignorant? It needs a framework. And that's, again, that's where that great freedom of integrating the Eightfold Path comes from. Because then you know you're good to go. You don't have to keep questioning yourself. Am I eye-making in this moment? If you're engaged in wrong speech, guess what? You're eye-making. Stop doing it. You're not wrong. You're not going to go to hell. Nobody's going to make you do anything. You don't got to go to confession unless you want to. Recognize that it's an unskillful act and simply practice restraint and let it go. Helen, you had a question, and then I want to finish the sutra.
Oversimplifying it, if I say the difference is between the I who has a 9 o'clock appointment and the ego. I mean, the I that we are is
yeah.
the ego.
Yeah, the I that has a 9 o'clock appointment is fine. The I that hates that it has to get up at 9 o'clock. there's the ego.
So, I mean, it's really just recognizing your ego.
It is.
Am I oversimplifying?
No, thank you. Please take this seat because I'm overcomplicating it, I think. it is that simple. recognizing and abandoning the self-referential ego self. That's the whole point. So what the Buddha's talking about here, it's what an auspicious day is. When you're mindfully present with life as life occurs, there's no you in it. There's no self-referential you. Let me... All right, Lorna.
Well, yeah, I just want to follow up on what Maura said, because she put the words into out there that I've never spoken, that I recognise straight away. That when I'm in Matt's class doing Qigong, it's only when you do let yourself, when you have no I in I, meaning the I making, that you ever have any Qi anyway. If you begin to try to get it or change it or it through I making, boom.
Yep, you lose it.
And you can physically experience it.
Yeah, there's a tightness there.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a tightness that develops.
And Maura just sort of outlined that, and I thought, oh, yeah, that's it. Well, I just have to, like, just say, I'm absolutely with her.
Mm-hmm. And in this way, what we're talking about, form, feelings, perceptions, we're unraveling this by clinging aggregates.
Yes, and when you do that, just like you can recognize
through the world in a skillful way, responding to what's happening rather than deciding with mental fabrications what's needed, what's not needed, how.
Just like you can recognize during Qigong that you're tightening now.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty quickly, you'll develop suppleness of mind to recognize when you're doing that to your mind, when you're eye-making.
Yeah.
You feel... The Buddha describes that wonderfully well in this one word, a confining space, two words.
Mm.
That's how he describes the quality of mind of a person stuck in wrong views, a confining space.
Mm-hmm.
And he would often refer to his life in the... Now, think about this. As that wealthy prince... That place was a confining space,
mm-hmm.
because his mind was a confining space during that time.
Mm-hmm.
We can recognize that. We did that little exercise, was it Tuesday night in class, about just feeling an agitated mind, an anguished mind. Just get it, what does it feel like? And we all can conjure it up because we've all felt that, don't we? We can get it, we can feel it instantly. That's an unawakened clinging mind. That's a mind rooted in ignorance. You can tell by how it feels. It doesn't feel good. Awakening is peaceful, it's calm. That's how the Buddha described an awakened human being. He didn't describe him in any mystical or magical or esoteric way. He said that mind is at peace, that mind is calm. That's awakened. It's also, if you think about what would be the quality of mind of a person who is fully mature? They'd be at peace because they know there's nothing else to do except just to live a life. Maybe we'll finish this tonight. now we got it.
That would be auspicious.
It would be. I read that, so I'm going to go back that one paragraph, though, just to put it back in context. Then I had the thought, the sixth sense base is dependent on the condition of name and form and dependent on self-referential views. This is the origination of the entire mass of suffering. Now I'm going to skip my commentary, and the Buddha continues. Vision arose, understanding arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illuminating insight. That's an important point because it's insight into the three marks of existence that the Buddha's teaching. It's not some general type of insight into everything that's occurring, although it's not a bad idea, it's just not part of the Dhamma. Illuminating insight arose within me with regards to things never heard before. And this speaks to that notion that many people want to adapt, that there was Buddhas going back infinitely into the past and there will be into the future. Even the Buddha uses that term, but notice what he's saying here. Things never heard before. What he's referring to about Buddhas, it has to be in the context, is what he's referring to is unawakened bodhisattvas. In the translation, again, now you're going to have to have a little bit of faith in me. The translation was wrong in that case. Because the Buddha wouldn't say there's infinite Buddhas in the past and infinite Buddhas in the future when he's the one that states things never heard before. Awakening is what he's describing here. With regards to things never known before, then I had the thought, what is the condition that the cessation of the stress of aging and death is dependent on? What is the condition? What does it originate in? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding from the cessation of birth. As the requisite condition comes the cessation of stress of aging, of the stress of aging and death. Now, notice that, again, there's no modifier or qualifier in the translation because it's in the context. So the way to say that in context is from the cessation of the birth of ignorance as the requisite condition, the initial condition of ignorance leads to mental fabrications, leads to all of the whole mass of suffering. From the cessation of the birth of ignorance as a requisite condition comes the cessation of the stress of aging and death. Bringing it right back to how the Buddha began describing his own awakening from the cessation of ignorance. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding from the cessation of consciousness, meaning thinking rooted in ignorance, as the requisite condition. The cessation of that consciousness, the cessation of thinking rooted in ignorance, is the requisite condition for the cessation of name and form. When the cessation of name and form occurs, there's no more feedback loop, is there? There's nothing left for that feedback loop to engage in. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of name and form, as the requisite condition comes the cessation of consciousness. He's now describing how to get out of that feedback loop. How do you do it? You stop it. You develop the skills that are necessary to recognize it, interrupt it, and bring it to cessation. Just my comment within the sutta. Notice a reference here and below to what the Buddha awakened to. And this is dependent origination. So the Buddha concludes this, or continues by saying, I have attained this path to awakening. Now let's finish this tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You don't want to hear the path, do you? I have attained this path to awakening. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact.
Slow down, John.
I'm excited.
I can't get it in that quick.
I'll go back to the beginning then. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. He's undoing the links of dependent origination. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. So obviously the Buddha's not saying that we just disappear, but those qualities that we were using to continue to reinforce ignorance no longer come into play. Certainly we still have our senses, but they're no longer part of the process of ignorance.
But he does do a little loop in the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From name and form comes... Consciousness,
main
form.
Yeah, they're both undone.
That's the feedback
in the same manner.
So that he described the undoing of the feedback loop as the beginning.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
This process.
You're extricating yourself from that ignorance. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. It simply means that we're now not using our sixth sense base in an ignorant way, rooted in ignorance. Ignorance, the cessation of becoming more ignorant. Is that clear? Excuse me. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming. Again, where's the qualifier, the modifier? In the context comes the cessation of becoming more ignorant. Lorna.
The sensation of contact is all the five senses. It's not the touch.
It's all the
all the five senses. It's sound, sight.
Yep.
Right.
And that ongoing consciousness rooted in ignorance, that ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance.
Right.
And in that sense, feeling is also not just an emotional feeling or just a physical feeling. Feeling in this sense is really any agitation of the mind that's rooted in ignorance. That's what feeling refers to here. So it's really every type of feeling, including that feeling of an agitated mind, even if we don't recognize it as agitated. From the cessation of becoming more ignorant comes the cessation of the birth of more ignorance. Now, let me read it the way it's in the sutta. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. Then I'll put my modifiers in there. From the cessation of becoming ignorant comes the cessation of the birth of ignorance. That process has been interrupted. And we did it through the intervention of the Eightfold Path. From the cessation of birth, then aging and death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair all cease. This is the cessation of the entire mass of stress, undoing what was rooted in ignorance. Vision arose, understanding arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illuminating insight arose within me with regards to things never known before. I'm going to skip out. I already mentioned that the Buddhist stating very clearly that this is a path that has never been here before. And now he qualifies. What's that path? Things never heard before. The Buddha's words, in this way, I saw a timeless path, meaning a path that is applicable. This is why it's part of a noble truth. Noble, as far as four noble truths, using the word noble refers to the idea of nobility, meaning a family that maintains their stature throughout generations. That's a noble family. You know, the Queen of England is an example of that. Something that persists throughout time. That's what it means. In this way, I saw a timeless path to be traveled by rightly self-awakened ones. Another important line. A lot of people will kind of gloss over that because maybe they feel it doesn't relate to them as a rightly self-awakened one. The Dhamma is a path of becoming rightly self-awakened. It's a path for rightly self-awakening. Those that engage in the Dhamma and awaken are rightly self-awakened ones.
It's not something that somebody does for you.
Yeah. You're rightly, and the Buddha emphasizes this over and over again, at referring to himself, but also referring to those that achieved arahantship during his lifetime. They were rightly self-awakened ones. That's the entire point of the Dhamma. The entire point of an auspicious day is to rightly self-awaken. And even the word rightly is important. How do we know it's right? How do we know we're engaging this in a right or skillful way? The Buddha describes it. And what is this timeless path traveled by rightly self-awakened ones? Anybody know what the answer is?
A noble eightfold path.
Just this noble eightfold path. And so then he describes it. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. How could something so unambiguous become so confused as to what the Buddha taught?
Because, like, what about something like Maha Kassapa, who, you know, like, Buddha held up the flower and he smiled, and he didn't travel, he didn't, you know, work through the Eightfold Path necessarily. Maybe he did, doesn't say that in the suttas. What was he doing before they held up the flower? So, I'm wondering if, you know, sometimes...
The legend of the flower I think it's just that, but it's even taken out of context. The Maha Kassapa, who the Buddha said had more, and I use the word loosely, more spiritual understanding than even he did, was teaching in the context, as everyone did that followed the Buddha, of Four Noble Truths. So if the legend of the flower actually occurred, and I don't believe that it ever did, because it doesn't relate in any way to any of the other teachings, just a magical awakening. It still happened in the context of a teacher who spent his life teaching Four Noble Truths. Maha Kassapa didn't wander around northern India for, I think he lived for 27 years, if I remember correctly, handing people lotus flowers and saying, you're awakening, or performing magic tricks. He went out there with his feet on the ground teaching the Dhamma to anyone that would listen and anyone that was interested. He didn't perform magic tricks. So that's why, I think that's a convenient legend that people use to say, well, awakening just happens spontaneously.
But we've talked about that before in here, I'm going to table that one. I'll catch you later on.
Okay. Yeah, there, again, these... you have to take it into context. Those stories are wonderful. It sounds like, wow, that's just great.
Well, where does that story fit anyhow? That's not coming out of the Sutta Pitaka.
No.
But wasn't that one of the first discourses?
No. Mm-hmm. No, that is...
Different flower.
No, it's in a sutra, not a sutta. Sutra is something that was developed much later. I'll figure it out and remember it. But it's not part of the Sutta Pitaka. But it is a legend that has grown that, this...
He was a student of the Buddha.
Mahakasapa, just to put it into context, Mahakasapa and Sariputta were two of the most significant early members of the Buddha Sangha. They were the ones that got it first. It's actually an interesting story. I should tell it one day, but I'll just tell it quickly. Sariputta says that if it wasn't for Mahakasapa, notice he doesn't say the Buddha, if it wasn't for Mahakasapa's support, he would have never awakened. Mahakasapa says the same thing. You see, the reason why I'm saying that is how important the early Sangha was in supporting each other. But of course, they were both practicing what the Buddha taught. So there wasn't any magic, instantaneous awakening. When I was in the chasing after the Zen ideal, I heard about this book by John Blofeld called an Instantaneous Awakening. And I wanted that book because that's what I wanted. And I couldn't, it was hard to find back then. It's easy to find now. It's back in publication. But man, I want to get my hands on this book because then I can be instantaneously awakened. And I finally got the book and I read it. And I waited. Man, I was just as disappointed as I was before I started the book. And then I was lucky enough through that disappointment to realize the Buddha didn't teach those kind of things. He taught practical ways that we can develop and rightly self-awaken. So, Maura, thanks for bringing that up.
With the personal responsibility of seeing for yourself how the Eightfold Path works.
Yes, you have to have you have to experience it. It only works through direct experience. And I thank Liz. What Liz is pointing out, that it's not enough just to read it. You can read those. How long does it take to read the Eightfold Path? Right, viewers, it takes a minute. You can read it over and over and over again. In fact, people have created these endless mantras, and that's going to deliver you. It doesn't.
Well, it's because we create our own eye making for ourselves.
Yeah.
Somebody else can take it away.
But we can engage in this wholeheartedly and awaken in this present lifetime. I mean, to me, that is I say the most remarkable thing. That is the most reasonable. Forget about the one I talked about before. This is the most remarkable thing. That we can take to the Dhamma and awaken in this lifetime, and more than likely by Sunday afternoon.
Through practice. But then all we get to do is live the Eightfold Path.
Then you have to do this. So the Buddha just described the Eightfold Path. And notice it's important. The words right view, right intention, etc., imply that there's such a thing as wrong view, and those are important words, but sometimes we can feel that there's moral connotations. It's just as accurate to say skillful view and unskillful view, skillful meditation, unskillful meditation, skillful mindfulness, unskillful mindfulness. But right and wrong kind of gets right to the heart of it. And the implication is that we all, because our minds are rooted in ignorance, we're all in an ongoing process that is rooted in wrong view. When the Buddha describes an awakened human being, another way that he would describe it is from that perspective. Right view is a view that understands at the most deeply and penetrating level, understands dukkha, understands the nature of suffering. That's how an awakened human being describes the purpose, understanding dukkha. So this is why I say that the Buddha could have nearly as accurately described the First Noble Truth as saying there is distraction, as saying there is dukkha, meaning the central problem. Because it is our preoccupation with dukkha that continues the distraction that allows ignorance to continue. While we waste our lives chasing after things that are meaningless. All right, I might continue. I might finish this tonight. The Buddha continues, this is a timeless path traveled by rightly self-awakened ones. I followed this path. If Siddhartha could follow it, it's a pretty good path to follow, isn't it? I followed this path. Following this path, I came to direct knowledge of the stress of aging and death. It's remarkable, isn't it? This is the one thing that should be taught everywhere. I'm not just talking about in Buddhism. Everywhere. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the origination of the stress of aging and death. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the cessation of the stress of aging and death. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of the stress of aging and death. It's not just a flower, it's a path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of birth, of becoming, of clinging, of craving, of feeling, of contact, of the sixth sense base, of name and form, and of consciousness. He came to direct knowledge of dependent origination. From ignorance through 12 observable links, all manner of confusion and suffering arises. And so his very first teaching was the teaching that describes the result of suffering. Four noble truths. Dukkha occurs. The first noble truth. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the origination of consciousness. Now remember, he's not talking, and this is where some of the modern adaptations, particularly in the Abhidhamma, really go off the rails, because they start using this, saying, now the Buddha's teaching a creation myth, how the physical universe came into being. Remember where this begins. It begins in ignorance. And so the Buddha's, the reference to consciousness is simply ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance, not some grand birth, giving birth to this great consciousness. It's ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the origination of consciousness. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the cessation of that consciousness, that thinking rooted in ignorance. Direct knowledge, meaning he had the experience of it. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of this eightfold path, leading to the cessation of that consciousness. Again, it's not something that we should be worried about. We don't lose the ability to think. We simply lose thinking rooted in ignorance, conditioned thinking. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of fabrications, the second factor of dependent origination. Following that, I came to direct knowledge of the origination of fabrications. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the cessation of fabrications. He's taken us all the way back to the beginning of dependent origination. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the eightfold path leading to the cessation of fabrications, of ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. Knowing the eightfold path directly, I have revealed it to monks, nuns, male lay followers, and female lay followers. I teach an eightfold path so that this path becomes powerful, rich, detailed, well-populated, widespread, and proclaimed by all wise beings. So my question to you, are you going to be a wise being or not? That's the end of tonight's talk. It's gotten a little late. It's 9:15, but are there any questions or comments about tonight's sutta? Pretty good lead into the retreat? Mm-hmm. Do you really think you're going to awaken by Sunday? I hope so. We can. I shouldn't be so flippant about that. There is really no reason why we don't. But we might not. Thank you all.
I've had some sleep tonight, maybe.
You all have the schedule, so I don't think I need to cover anything. Anything else? Oh, the Wan Dharma Center didn't request this. They did. The reason I'm saying it, they did a couple of retreats ago. But it would be really wonderful if on each meal, one or two of you would just go into the kitchen and help wash the dishes. Not required. I'm not saying you should do it, but it would be nice. And I'll leave it up to you to work that out when you do it. You know, even though the retreat isn't free, we pay for it, they really do go above and beyond what they need to do. They go way above and beyond just providing a place for us to have. And the place they provide is really wonderful, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So it's just a way of giving back and being part of their community, too.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons license 4.0. Peace.